Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Once again, I'm very grateful to see you all. Thank you very much for coming. I'm Jamie Shea. I'm the head of policy planning at NATO. And for those of you who were present at my previous lecture, you will know that this is a series which is devoted to new threats and challenges as NATO embarks on a new strategic concept to equip it for the 21st century, based on the work of Madeleine Albright and a group of independent experts. One of the key tasks, of course, of the group will be to review security today. What are the new threats? What are the new challenges? How seriously will they impact on NATO security in the years to come? To what degree is NATO the solution or part of the solution? Last time, just to recap, we looked at proliferation and the role of nuclear deterrence in the 21st century, or at least to be a little bit more modest, in the first decades of the 21st century. Who knows what will be happening at the tail end of the 21st century. And today I want to look at something, of course, which with the Copenhagen summit, a subject which is very, very much in the news, and I know from my own children is something which is very much at the top of everybody's agenda, and that's climate change, and particularly the impact of climate change on security and the role of security policy in helping, if not to stop climate change, at least to mitigate some of the more adverse consequences. As always, I'd be very happy to take your questions once I've finished. Now, we all know, with all of the newspaper articles on Copenhagen at the moment, that climate change remains a very controversial topic. There are those at one end of the spectrum who have come up with truly apocalyptic scenarios for the end of the world, reminiscent of some of the Hollywood blockbuster movies on the freezing temperatures or massive floods or freak weather conditions. Of course, those scenarios are somewhat very scary and even may induce a mood of panic or resignation. What can we do rather than a mood of resistance and mitigation? At the other end of the spectrum, there are those who believe the whole thing is being exaggerated and hyped. The climate of the Earth has never been particularly stable. True, the ice ages took place 500,000 years ago. In fact, the last ice age only ended 12,000 years ago, which is a nanosecond in history. We have seen the Earth heat up and cool down several times over the last centuries. For example, it's generally calculated that the Middle Ages was a cold period, whereas in the 17th century, things hotted up, at least for a while. And you cannot, of course, in the pre-industrial ages, blame humanity for those changes of temperature. So the other end of the spectrum believes that climate change is exaggerated, that if there are variations, they are not necessarily going to stop civilization or industrial society as we know. And sometimes, of course, the extremes, as in many political debates, tend to negate each other. The common sense in the middle ground, what we do know, tends to get somewhat overshadowed. So today, without claiming in any way to be an expert on climate change, but certainly somebody who is interested in it from a security policy viewpoint, I'm going to try to concentrate on the middle ground of what is basically known and what is basically the subject of consensus. Many of you will be familiar with the reports, four of them so far, of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or with the UN Environmental Programme, which have brought thousands of scientists together from all different disciplines, from all different countries, and it's basically the consensus of their thinking that I want to base myself on today. Now, what we know is that although, yes, as I said a moment ago, droughts, freak weather conditions, have existed throughout history. Indeed, civilizations in Peru, for example, in Mesopotamia, in the ancient world, are even believed to have been terminated through climate change, such as drought. So yes, although, as I said, we know that this is not a new phenomenon, what does seem to be pretty clear and should be beyond question is that the pace of climate change is accelerating. Things are happening faster than they did in the past. And secondly, most of the change is now caused by mankind, and not simply through natural fluctuations in ecological conditions. The increasing evidence is the fact that since 1850, we have had hot and cold summers, obviously, but the hottest summers, 23 out of the 24 since 1850, have occurred in the last 40 years. And indeed, the last couple of summers, and those of you who live in Belgium would have experienced this with great pleasure, of course, they've been amongst the hottest on record. Some of you may recall back in 2003, the extremely high temperatures in Europe, which led to the deaths of 15,000 people in France and about nearly 60,000 people in Europe overall. And French cabinet ministers were called back from their summer holidays to deal with what became a real social problem of the lack of everybody on holiday, the lack of emergency services available to take care of people, particularly old people who were the most vulnerable, who were suddenly dying from the extreme heat. We know that hurricanes are becoming more violent and more regular, without necessarily only focusing on Katrina in the United States. There's been a 50% increase in hurricanes over the last 50 years. We know that 99% of all the glaciers in the world are now receding at an average rate of 35 miles retraction every 10 years. Years. If we look at, for example, CO2 emissions, which of course is the standard of measurement, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we know that in the 1,000 years before 1800, which was really the beginning of industrialization in Europe, the levels were between 270 to 290 parts per million, PPMs. By 2007, the level had gone up to nearly 400 parts per million. So that means that today there is 40% more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than in the pre-industrial times. Now, this, of course, has caused a worry about rising sea levels, where much of the energies of the community are now focused. 2 billion people in the world live in coastal areas, unsurprisingly, because coastal areas have often been the most fertile, with deltas often closest to commerce, because commerce, of course, first developed with ports on the coast, and coasts tended to develop faster than the inland. Think of Australia, think of China, think of the United States. And therefore, much of the attention is focused on how much sea levels are likely to rise in the decades ahead. Here, of course, the experts, as you would imagine, differ in not whether sea levels will rise, but by how much. The general view is that if this is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that if the level goes up by about 60 centimetres by the end of the century, then the Maldives will probably go under. And you may have seen on your TV just a couple of weeks ago the first ever cabinet meeting of the government of the Maldives taking place on the bottom of the ocean, which was to illustrate the consequences of climate change. People will have to do their activities underwater. The Nigerian Delta would be gravely threatened. Millions of people would be under threat in Bangladesh, which is a country particularly vulnerable to flooding. The Nile Delta in Egypt, and several Pacific islands, for example, Kivalu, the Marshall Islands, also would be threatened. Indeed, a couple of months ago, I had a academic and a former military officer from New Zealand in my office, and it was quite interesting to see how far New Zealand is planning now to evacuate and to resettle in New Zealand the inhabitants of many of the Pacific Islands. And those who live in the Marshall Islands have already negotiated with the United States an arrangement to be able to resettle in the United States. This actually, by the way, this is just an aside, but this poses absolutely fascinating questions for international lawyers. If a country like the Maldives goes underwater, does it still exist? No, but it's not a joke. Would it still control its territorial waters in terms of fishing or in terms of mineral exploration? Would it still have a status in the international community? Because there would be a people, but without necessarily a territory. There's just one aspect to show you just how complicated climate change is going to be. Another report called the World Development Report, which came out in 2007, calculates that if temperatures rise by about 3% to 4%, by the middle of the century, which is one of the more alarmist scenarios, admittedly, about 330 million people in the world would be immediately threatened by catastrophic flooding, 70 million in Bangladesh, for instance, 6 million in Lower Egypt, and up to 22 million in Vietnam. So rising sea levels are obviously a major factor. Other estimates point to the increasing likelihood of droughts. At the moment, about 1.3% of the world's territory is calculated to be particularly prone to drought. That could rise by up to 30% by the end of the century if we are unable to control climate change. And of course, that has consequences for agricultural production, with declining amounts of arable land, food scarcity, and all the rest. Forests are also, as you know, particularly the Amazon Basin, there's been a lot of publicity there, are of particular concern because we know that about 50 to 80% of animals and plants are dependent upon a forest habitat. And forests currently only now cover 6% of the global surface of the world. Forests are the absence of forests, the contraction of forests, is responsible today for about 20%. Of the increase in CO2 emissions. And that also has consequences for the more rapid extinction of species. Again, I'm not a biologist, but my research tells me that there have been about 14 million different types of species since the dawn of creation. But the extinction rate is now calculated by scientists to be running at about 1,000 times more than in the pre-industrial age. So forests, of course, are going to be critical in combating climate change. And then finally, in terms of, you know, what we know is out there, all of you are aware of this, of course, it's the melting of the polar ice pack, particularly in the north, for reasons that are not completely clear to me. As I say, I'm not a scientist, but the Arctic is melting at a much faster rate than the Antarctic, although melting is taking place, as you know, at both ends of the Earth. But any of you who've seen a satellite image of the Arctic 20 years ago and see a satellite image of the Arctic today, you know, the contraction has been spectacular. It's been calculated that in about 20 years, during the summer, the ice will melt entirely. Of course, as always in these debates, there are winners as well as losers, because if you are a shipping company taking oil from Europe to Tokyo, that cuts 40% off your journey, and therefore 2 weeks off your cruising time, and potentially thousands upon thousands of dollars off your operating costs. The Northwest Passage will be open. And of course, if you're an energy company, the prospect getting access to 25% of the world's known gas and oil reserves, which have been in the past under permafrost in the Arctic, but now become accessible, is a very attractive, or possibly attractive, particularly with deep sea drilling these days, commercial prospect. So there are always winners and losers. But still, the rise in water levels levels, would have major consequences for the flooding scenarios that I've just outlined. Now, ladies and gentlemen, what does the sort of this mean in terms of consequences? Well, first of all, of course, we have the problem of hotter temperatures being conducive to disease. The World Health Organization calculates that 25% of the preventable diseases in the world today are caused by poor environmental conditions. Now, that is not necessarily all directly connected with climate change. I mean, if you pump dust out of a coal power plant, clearly, any of you have been in some parts of China recently will know what I'm talking about. Clearly, this obviously means that you have to go around with a mask and the rest. But climate change is certainly a factor in exacerbating these type of conditions. The United Nations calculates that there are about 25 million environmental refugees in the world today. And some conflicts, particularly the one in Darfur, are generally now thought to be, if not the first sort of environmental conflict, at least exacerbated, made worse by climate change. For example, fighting conflict between nomadic tribes who move around, called pastoralists in the jargon, and the more sedentary farmers as they have disputes over the ownership of land, or people are forced to move to more fertile areas. Indeed, in particularly in Africa, and I have more to say about this in a moment, droughts, flood conditions can have truly catastrophic economic effects. It's calculated that whereas in the industrialized countries, land or nature only constitutes about 2% of GDP, most comes from, you know, industry, from services, etc. In the lesser developed countries, or the countries at early stages of development, the natural capital can constitute up to 26% of gross domestic product. So therefore, floods, hurricanes, disruptions to agriculture can wipe off, as for example, floods did a few years ago in Mozambique, 6% of GDP. Or drought in Kenya is calculated to have wiped out 20% of GDP in 1 year alone because of the failure of hydroelectric power and so on. Snow melts are also a worry. For example, for NATO in Afghanistan, the large droughts, which are attributable to the lack of melting snow from the Himalayas, 1 billion people, for example, are calculated to benefit from the snow melt every year of the Himalayas. That drought has a direct consequence. It's not economically viable to grow wheat, so you grow a crop that for which you need very little water. That crop is called poppy, and that's the source of the narcotics trade, which funds the Taliban insurgency, which fuels corruption, as we know, and gives NATO mega headaches, not to speak of the 90% of Afghanistan's heroin, which ends up in Brussels or Amsterdam or London on the streets of the Allied capitals. The other thing, of course, is we now know that we are consuming the world's resources at a much faster rate because of population growth, but also because more and more countries have used globalization to get access to Western standards of living. Let me quote Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, in 1928. He was prophetic about a lot of things. He said, "God forbid that India should ever take to industrialism after the manner of the West. If an entire nation of 300 million, that was the Indian population in 1928, today it's what, 1.3 billion? If an entire nation of 300 million took to similar economic exploitation, it would strip the world bare like locusts." Of course, today, China, India hanker after Western living standards. 7,000 new cars are registered in China every single day of the week. In the 20th century, these figures, I think, are extremely illuminating. In the 20th century, world population, quadrupled. The urban population went up by 13 times. In fact, the UN reported a few years ago that the number of people living in cities for the first time in history surpasses the number of people not living in cities. Output went up by 40 times. Energy consumption by 13 times. CO2 emissions 17 times. Consumption of water went up by 9 times. Fishing, the catch of fish, went up by 35 times. The world economy also grew 14 times. And of course, this is therefore the fundamental sort of equation of climate change. To what degree can the world economic development and therefore wealth to fix climate change grow pro rata to CO2 emissions so that we have the money to fix the problem as it gets worse? Indeed, this is what I think is truly fascinating and challenging, is that climate change is the mother of all threats. It's the first threat that concerns every country in the world at the same time, in which no continent escapes. This has never happened before. The threats that we're talking about in this lecture series, like proliferation or terrorism or cyber, yes, are probably more universal today than they were 20 or 30 years ago. But arguably, it's still a limited number of countries that are directly affected. Climate change is different. It's the first universal threat, which can only be solved universally. Secondly, the financial implications of fixing climate change are staggeringly high. Higher than the financial costs of fixing the other problems. In fact, some of the other problems, like proliferation, don't really require a great expense at all. They require more diplomacy than expense. But it's been calculated, for example, that to decarbonize the economies of the major industrialized countries would cost $20 trillion. China, which is now taking climate change seriously, alone estimates that it's going to need $300 billion a year simply to be able to stabilise in 2030 its emissions at the level which they are at today. So it's going to be essential, yes, that we grow the economy in such a way that we have the money to fix these problems. But without the growing of the economy, industrialization, energy-intensive industries such as cement or whatever, car production, leading to even more CO2 emissions. That, if I can use a phrase, is the catch-22 situation in which we find ourselves. So clearly, there are more people on Earth who all want to live like the West has been able to live for a certain period of time already. Now, what else do we know? We also know that certain regions are going to be more vulnerable initially than others. Africa, I've mentioned already, through drought, water scarcity, a loss of 75% of the rain-fed land. Indeed, according to a recent European Commission report of 2008, 70% of Africans and 90% of poor Africans work in agriculture, which is likely, of course, to be most directly affected, and therefore leading to the scenario of mass migration heading towards Europe. To some degree, we're already seeing this phenomenon every year with all of the boat people who try to come to Spain or the Canary Islands, and the increased EU naval activity in that region to deal with that issue. Another region is the Middle East, which is going to be particularly vulnerable to water shortages. It's calculated that 2 out of every 3 people on the planet today live in an environment of water scarcity. Water is going to be more precious than oil in the 21st century and possibly far more expensive. For example, China, 400 out of its 650 cities, according to the World Bank, face water shortages. The Middle East is an area where this is particularly a problem. According to the World Bank, 80 to 100 million people in the Middle East will be exposed by 2025 to water stress, which of course will reduce irrigation and crop yields. South Asia, there the scenario is mainly from sea level rise. 2 billion people live within 60 kilometres of the coastline. World Bank fears that crop yields will decrease by 30% by the mid-21st century. Now, let me make it clear, these are just predictions. These are based on computer simulations, projections. I'm not offering them, of course, as gospel truth. Who knows? And, of course, this is without the remedies, which I will describe in a moment, kicking in. But let me make one thing clear here. A scientist needs to be totally certain of something through testing, through verification, validity, before a scientist can put something out. A policymaker doesn't have to be. A policymaker cannot afford to sit back and wait for irrefutable evidence of a threat to be here, because then it's too late to react. A policymaker has to make, a calculated guess of how something is likely to develop. Of course, you have to have the best information available, but a policymaker is not somebody who needs to wait for mass flooding or droughts to occur before saying, Houston, we have a problem. Central Asia, particularly because of the melting of the glaciers. The glaciers in Tajikistan, for instance, have already lost in the second half of the 20th century about half of their water-bearing capacity. Kyrgyzstan is calculated to have lost 1,000 glaciers in the second half of the 20th century. Latin America and the Caribbean, problems of salinization, salt, and desertification of agricultural land. And finally, I mentioned this already, the Arctic. So those are the regions where the focus is at the moment. Now, ladies and gentlemen, when we look at climate change, there are sort of two sort of schools. One school sees basically a continuation of current trends, which is some mitigation efforts, but a continuous growth in CO2 emissions. In this scenario, we are likely by the middle of the century to come out at around 1.4% to 2% in terms of climate, the warming of the climate. Generally, 2%, as you know better than I, is seen as the kind of watermark, if that's the right word, benchmark for controllable climate change vis-a-vis beyond 2% or 2 degrees, 2 degrees. Uncontrollable climate change. And so first scenario is the linear development. Now, under this scenario, the strategic community sees climate change as something which is not going to create problems itself, but is more going to exacerbate already existing tensions. So in other words, if you've got a water dispute somewhere, climate change makes it worse. If you've got a dispute over agricultural land, climate change is going to make it worse. If you're living in a drought-stricken area like the Sahel, it's going to get even more drought-stricken. If you're living in a dry area, it's going to get drier. And if you're living in a wet area, it's going to get wetter. But under this scenario, you do have winners. I mentioned, if you look at the Financial Times today, for example, there's a big article about the English wine industry. With lots of very, very happy people who now think, hey, we can grow, good wines to compete with the Bordeaux and the Bourgogne, because the British climate now becomes like the climate of Spain or Italy, and therefore the grapes will ripen. At a time, of course, when, if you look at Bordeaux, the big problem with their wine is because of the heat, the grapes are ripening too quickly, and not maturing, and therefore producing very poor quality wine. So yes, as always in life, there are winners and losers. But the second group is the more alarmist group, which sees what are called positive feedback loops. I love this expression. Positive feedback loops. You learn all kinds of interesting expressions when you study climate change. This is essentially the idea of global warming, which becomes mutually sort of accelerating. And therefore goes up to 4 degrees or 5 degrees hotter, where climate change does become a problem in its own right and no longer simply an exacerbator of existing trends. The main worry here is methane. It's calculated that there are between anything in the region of about 500 billion tons of methane under the ice packs, polar, North Pole, South Pole. methane is 23 times more potent than carbon. There's methane already in the atmosphere. In fact, a little bit of carbon and methane in the atmosphere is good, because otherwise we would live on a very cold planet. And we don't want to live, by the way, on Mars, which is so cold that it shatters, the temperature would shatter still on Mars. So clearly, you know, a little bit of warming is good for us, and has always been there. We would never get a tan on the beach without it. But the main concern is that when the ice melts, the methane is released, and then that produces a cycle of warming, leading to more warming, and so on. A positive feedback loop there. So that is one particular concern, that we could then have warming that would get out of control. So, ladies and gentlemen, what are we going to do about it? Well, it's not the purpose of this lecture, because, of course, I'm not a scientist or I'm not an economist, to talk to you about everything that's going to be discussed in Copenhagen in just a couple of days' time. Yes, clearly, we have to have binding limits. The European Union, with the 20% proposed cut by 2020, has already taken the lead. From the newspapers today, you will have seen that Barack Obama is offering a 17% cut by the United States. You will see that China and India have not yet announced their targets, but they are definitely taking climate change more seriously than a few years ago, when China was planning to build, within the next 10 years, 500 coal-powered power stations. Because, of course, it doesn't make much sense for the European Union to cut by 20% if, in the meantime, China and India and other countries are continuing to put more stuff into the atmosphere. So the European Union must not just set an example, but carry the rest of the world along with it. And, of course, we need to have a legal arrangement, which is verifiable, so countries don't make up their own statistics, and we have a true assessment of whether they're complying or not. And we need, of course, to come up with carbon capture and storage, and the transfer of technologies, particularly to the poorer countries. And we also need to come up with a model which does not base industrialization on very CO2 producing industries like cement, which I mentioned a moment ago. The remedies are well identified. It's simply a question of the political will to implement them. No, as a security policy person, what I'd like to do in the final few minutes of my lecture remaining is to say something about the strategic consequences. Now, of course, this is speculation, of course. It's educated guesswork based on existing trends. But what would I see? First of all, bad consequences for the oil producers. There are a lot of countries today, think of Russia, think of Saudi Arabia, think of Venezuela, that derive 80% plus of their exports and earnings from mineral resources, oil, gas in particular. And if we are going to transfer to a carbon neutral or low carbon economy, then of course the demand for oil and gas will go down sharply. For example, the demand for Russian gas is calculated to fall by 40% between now and 2020 as Europe converts to solar power, to wind power, to biofuels and other things. Sheikh Yamani, you don't remember Sheikh Yamani, he's been dead for a long time, but he used to be the Saudi oil minister in the 1970s when OPEC, you remember OPEC, increased the oil prices four times after the Yom Kippur War. He once said the Stone Age did not end for lack of stones, and the Oil Age will end before we run out of oil. And that was a prophetic statement. So the first consequence I see, if you're a Saudi or a Russian or a Venezuelan, is that you're going to have to start now. And President Medvedev of Russia has recognised this in a recent speech, in converting your economy away from over-dependence on oil and gas. And use the money that you're earning from oil and gas today to make the conversion. In fact, many economists, such as Martin Wolf of the Financial Times, say anyway that oil is a curse, and that those countries which do not have oil have grown in the last 50 years between two and three times faster than those countries with oil and natural gas. So that's one. The second consequence, and I touched on this for those of you who were at my lecture a couple of weeks ago on proliferation, is there's going to be a large expansion of nuclear power around the world. The nuclear industry is once again salivating at the prospect of a dynamic business model as more and more countries seek to replace fossil fuels by using fourth generation nuclear power, safer. But, of course, will it be safe if all of those countries start developing, like Iran or like North Korea, their own fuel cycles, producing their own plutonium or uranium, which can then, without international controls, easily be diverted to making nuclear bombs? How can we ensure that we use nuclear power for peaceful purposes and not for military purposes? The third thing is the divide between rich and poor. The president of Uganda, Museveni, has said that climate change is an act of aggression of the rich against the poor. This may be a somewhat exaggerated statement, but it's clear that the rich countries have done the pollution, but the poor will be the most vulnerable, at least able to protect themselves. If you're in the Netherlands, and you have a problem of flooding historically, you're in a much better position to build the dikes, yes? The arcs of the 21st century than if you're Bangladesh with a similar kind of problem. And clearly, you know, and this has come up in the debate already, the poor would expect the rich, first of all, to deal with their own problem first, but secondly, to transfer wealth to them so that they can deal with the problem as well. This doesn't happen, to what degree will this lead globally to major tensions? Not just the problem of migration, but political tensions as well. And of course, this then brings me down to the next issue, which is that of terrorism. Osama bin Laden has written in 2007 a letter to America in which he too has tried to exploit climate change as another Western plot against the Muslim countries, which again is going to exacerbate religious tensions as well, because many countries in the Middle East, as I pointed out earlier, are particularly vulnerable to this. Indeed, the 25 richest countries of the world are today responsible for 90% of the CO2 emissions. If you put China, which is still a developing or developed country, together with the United States, it represents 40% of global emissions. But there is no doubt that these are potential sources of enormous ideological battles of the future, which extremists will be able to exploit, to the extent that the polluting countries are seen as the aggressors. The United States pumps out about 20 tonnes per capita per year of CO2. Bangladesh, it's less than half a tonne at the present time. So to what degree are the rich countries prepared to take responsibility and not just protect themselves, but protect others? The role of China, of course, also is going to be crucial in this respect. China is now the largest polluter, but be careful, it's not the largest per capita polluter. Way behind. It's about one third of the EU level at the moment, and way behind the US level. In fact, the biggest per capita is not the United States, by the way, it's Australia per capita at the moment. But China has been catching up fast in terms of growth rates. In fact, its CO2 emissions doubled between 1996 and 2000. One third of Chinese arable land is now unusable. Can what used to be called Red China many years ago become Green China in the 21st century? The positive part is that the Chinese are now taking this very seriously, developing wind power. In fact, China has the world's best solar power industry today. They even sell solar panels to the United States. But of course, the ability of China to grip this problem is also, I think, going to be very important. It's going to be massively important that a country which is developed, is part of the international effort together with the Western countries to take the lead on climate prevention. So, finally, 1 minute. Where does this leave NATO and the security community? Well, clearly, we need people in Copenhagen to do their job. We do, to the extent that, you know, they come up with a new treaty, they set targets, they come up with the money. In fact, the less we spend on oil, the more money we're going to have to pay for the new technologies. It's calculated, for example, that the Western countries transfer to the oil producers about $1.5 trillion a year. So the more money we can save by using less oil, the more we can afford to transfer the technologies elsewhere. So clearly, yes, we have an interest, as I say, in these frameworks working out. But we also have to prepare for the worst case scenarios, for things going wrong, or even the consequences of a two degree warming, because it's calculated that even if the developed countries today had a totally carbon free economy, which is not likely, we would still go up to 2 degrees warming just based on past trends. So rather like, you know, the car where you normally have your headlights dipped, you know, your headlights dipped immediately in front of you, looking at the immediate road ahead, we need to put the headlights on and have the a car looking way down the road at what's coming in the future. Now, what does this mean? I think the first thing is the military are going to be more involved in dealing with natural disasters, hurricanes, floods. Military engineers will be more important to rapidly build dams, repair roads, get power lines working again. The US deployed 30,000 troops to cope with Hurricane Katrina a few years ago. The police were completely overwhelmed. The troops alone could keep order. They're going to have more helicopters. They're going to have more flat-bottom boats to be able to evacuate people trapped on roofs in flood conditions. Don't think it's a joke. We had a case just last weekend in the United Kingdom of a village in Cumbria which was totally flooded and where people had to be taken by helicopter off their roofs. It doesn't only happen in places like the United States where hurricanes occur frequently. So clearly we are going to have the military much more involved with the police, with the health authorities, with the emergency rescue services, in planning for the consequences of disasters, natural disasters at home, and to be trained and ready on standby to deal with it. The tsunami, I'm not saying the tsunami was caused by climate change, but that where NATO sent the NATO response force to Pakistan build hospitals and to evacuate people, where the American Navy went to Aceh after the tsunami, shows that this is also an excellent public diplomacy tool. NATO's mission in Pakistan built a relationship with the Pakistanis that did not exist, just like the US role in Aceh helped in the world's most populous Muslim country, Indonesia, to change attitudes to the United States after the so-called global war on terror. So I would therefore say that the first consequence for us is that clearly we are going to have to be prepared to deal with those consequences. Refugees, migration flows, I mentioned this earlier, is something where we also are going to have to be involved. Look at also what we call the comprehensive approach in NATO. We see in Afghanistan that we can't solve the problem without cooperation with the EU, without cooperation with the United Nations, without the civilians and the military working closer together. And we need to develop those relations with the other international organisations also to deal with climate change and to use their information, their projections, their scenarios. At the moment, NATO countries, it's calculated, spend less than 0.5% of their defence budgets on activities relating to climate change. That will have to change in the years ahead. Already my country, the United Kingdom, is thinking of having a defence green paper, a study on climate change, and the United Kingdom convened a meeting of the UN Security Council, the first ever in 2007, to start looking at climate change. I mean, what would be the security consequences in the world if climate change leads to a defective ecology, lower economic growth, scarcity of food, of water, of resources, if it put weak states, collapsing states, under greater pressure and accelerates their collapse, or if it leads to the collapse of governance, or even the emergence of new centres of authority, like warlords, for example, or regional ethnic groups. I'm not saying that this is going to happen tomorrow or that we can predict everything, but we have to start preparing for these scenarios, looking at the regions most likely to be affected, looking at timelines, and following this carefully. This is not something where we can be caught by surprise. The naval aspect, much of what I've spoken about concerns water, flooding, hurricanes, policing the Arctic against environmental disasters if more fuel tankers are going to start transiting through that very lonely area of the world. What do you do if there's a disaster, two oil tankers collide and there's a major spill? Who intervenes in those consequences? For example, piracy is a maritime problem caused by overfishing. The fact that fish stocks have begun to become very scarce. The Somali fishermen who used to catch fish now catch ships as an alternative source of livelihood. So again, the maritime dimension of policing will be important. And yet, if you look at my country, the United Kingdom, we have at the moment we have more admirals than ships at the moment. Lord Nelson would roll in his grave. But Britain, one of the world's traditional greatest maritime powers today, has more admirals than ships. 45 admirals, 43 ships. The US Navy was 600 ships at the time of President Reagan 20 years ago. Today, it's under 300 ships. So investing more in maritime as well as helicopters will be key. We need greater early warning mechanisms. We need to find out how can we gather intelligence, early warning about climate change tipping countries into conflict or chaos or instability. We need to consult more in the alliance on these particular dangers. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, we need to reduce our own carbon footprint. The military burn up oil faster than anybody else. About 250 billion litres of jet fuel every year. That's a lot of tons of CO2 in the atmosphere. A NATO tank, consumes a gallon a second of fuel on operations. Not even my very old motor car consumes at quite that rate, thank God. Indeed, look at Afghanistan. We have an enormous need for fuel into Afghanistan. And last year, 170 people were killed, mainly in Pakistan on the transit route, just trying to deliver fuel to the NATO military in Afghanistan. And with more troops in Afghanistan, we need even more fuel. So if we can reduce our fuel consumption, we're actually going to make our lives a lot easier and save lives in terms of the supply lines to our operations. So we need to reduce our own carbon footprint as well. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's going to cost us a lot of money to fix the planet over the next few years. But it's probably going to cost us even more money, vastly greater sums, to deal with the consequences of not fixing climate change over the next few years. Also, what could potentially cause the world's largest conflicts, paradoxically, can also bring the world together under a new form of governance. The G20 has emerged to deal with the financial crisis, to bind in China, India, who increasingly waking up to the consequences of climate change for them, to also bring in Russia as it becomes more aware of the need to form a government. In other words, climate change offers perhaps the first possibility that we've known since the UN was founded in 1945, albeit with only 50 countries in the world in that day, to bring about a true form of world governance. And if we can establish this to deal with the climate, the world's most serious and difficult problem, think what that world governance could then do for dealing with the financial crisis, for dealing with terrorism, for dealing with AIDS, and for dealing with disease and development more generally. So humanity has everything to lose, but perhaps also everything to win from the challenge of climate change. Thank you. Thank you very much.
How do you think territorial claims in the melting Arctic will influence NATO-Russian relationships, and how should NATO react to this?
Well, I think so far the news hasn't been that bad. As I've said, you know, there's always paradoxes in life, and something which could cause a lot of friction, like disputes over territorial claims and drilling rights and mineral access in the Arctic, so far has produced a lot of cooperation. I can't remember the name of this town in Greenland, very difficult to pronounce, but where the local powers, the Canadians, the United States, the Danes, the Russians, the Norwegians, the countries which have an interest, have met, and they have agreed to put this to the adjudication of the United Nations in terms of the Russian Lemonotsov Ridge, you know, which goes virtually all the way to the North Pole, and abide by the results, which is very positive thus far. And obviously what NATO is interested in is in a peaceful settlement, legal arrangements. The Russians obviously will also need vast amounts of capital and lots and lots and lots of Western technology, particularly Norwegian deep sea drilling technology, if they're going to seriously exploit the resources in this area. Indeed, as I say, if the world comes off carbon, if the oil price goes down, if the gas price goes down, it may not be commercially very attractive, frankly, for anybody to spend a hell of a lot of money trying to develop these resources. Because, you know, if the oil price is $200 a barrel, yes, you know, you want to develop those resources. But if the oil price is $20 a barrel, it's not viable. So let's wait and see. Now, I think that, frankly, and this is where an opportunity for NATO arises, the biggest problem is not sort of 19th century, you know, great game, great power rivalry in the Arctic. It's more the fact that there will be more and more tankers and ships going up there. You know, we've seen already what happens when a tanker collides with another one and you have an oil spill, environmental consequences, the rescue of crews. And I think it's more of a search and rescue mission for the alliance, which, by the way, gives us an opportunity to cooperate with Russia. You know, I make no secret, our relationship with Russia has sometimes been a fraught one. And therefore, we need to find areas where they have an interest in working with us as we do with them. For example, although this is not related directly, but the Russians have a ship in the Gulf of Aden dealing with piracy, which they also see as a threat to their commercial interests. They need trade as much as we do. And therefore, we can perhaps, you know, in terms of joint maritime controls, a joint intelligence network, joint satellite supervision of the area, you know, come together in this sort of policing role of dealing with tankers in difficulty or any natural disasters. That's where I see it.
You seem to be not too positive about the whole climate change, from what I heard from you. So I got a question. You're already focusing on the consequences and what we can do in the future with the consequences, but what do you think that Copenhagen will do? And another question is, how do you see the power of OPEC in this whole thing?
Well, yep. First of all, again, I'm not an economist or a climate scientist, and therefore I'm not somebody who is involved, of course, in the negotiations for Copenhagen. What is clear is that the Kyoto Protocol, which is the existing UN framework, as you know, which has been in place since the early 1990s, is due to expire in 2012. We are going to be in 2010 very soon. And these new arrangements take time to come into play. So we must have a positive result in Copenhagen if we're going to have a new treaty, a new framework in place by 2012. We can't wait until the 31st of December 2011, or we'll be in a period in which there is, in fact, no international regime, which, in dealing with such an important problem, would be very, very, very bad. So we need, at the minimum, I think, in Copenhagen, what's called a framework agreement. In other words, the lawyers may not have time, you know, to draft the treaty and to write in every obligation, but we need a basic agreement that on an agreed target by the main polluting countries, a binding commitment to cut their emissions. That's clear. At the moment, there are some countries, like the United States, that are suggesting cutting to 2005 levels, whereas the European Union is proposing cutting back to 1990 levels. Now, as the carbon emissions were lower in 1990 than they were in 2005, obviously, the more countries that commit not only to ambitious cuts, but cutting back to 1990 levels, so reversing much of the damage of the last few years, that's going to be the first positive result. So significant targets which not only sort of stop the acceleration of climate change, but actually start to reverse it. That's clear. So it's not a question of just, you know, doing it, but more slowly. We've got to now put it into reverse and make the prospect of carbon-free economies by the end of this century a realistic one, because that has to be our aim. As I said, even if we have carbon-free economies, we're still going to see, at least for the next couple of decades, a warming by 2 degrees of the planet. Second thing, accept that the treaty must be a legally binding one. We have to have a legally binding one subject to international supervision and controls, not countries simply declaring their own results, because who knows if those results are true. The third thing is that there has to be a commitment by the richer countries to transfer technology to the poorer countries, particularly what's called carbon capture and storage. You know, you can use coal-fired power stations, that's fine, provided that you capture the carbon through a filtering process, and then you bury the carbon in the ground in order to store it. So that for poor countries who can't afford nuclear power stations and who continue to rely upon coal or whatever or burning biofuels, these technologies are very, very important, because they cannot obviously be told, sorry, but you have to stop your development because of climate change. We've had our development, we've enjoyed it, thank you very much, but you have to remain poor because you have to sacrifice yourselves so that we can stabilise the planet. So we have to find, I think, in Copenhagen, acceptable compromise between the need to continue development, to bring people out of poverty. You know, globalisation has already brought, in Asia alone, 300 million people out of poverty over the last 20 years. We need to be able to continue that, but do it in a clean way. So it's going to be important. I think the third thing is that we need a proper international cap-and-trade scheme. You've heard of this. I mean, this is awfully technical and complicated sometimes, but that we need a proper scheme that really is meaningful, that companies can buy permits in order to produce CO2s, but be properly taxed for it. If carbon emission is tax-free, then people are going to do it. I mean, if you pay for a product at the moment, but if you paid for the carbon that went into manufacturing that product would become much more expensive. So we need to have a proper price on CO2, which reflects its real value in terms of the damage it can do to the environment. And therefore, there has to be a cap-and-trade system, for example, which means that countries that, on the one hand, have a permit to produce CO2, compensate by giving money to Brazil to preserve the Amazon forest. As a carbon sink, as it's called, to absorb that carbon. This is complicated stuff, but the scheme has to be a real one that makes sense and not to sort of give the appearance of controlling climate change, while in reality enabling business as usual. That's what we've got to avoid. So even if we don't have an agreement at Copenhagen in terms of the legal arrangements, the framework has got to be a serious one, and there's got to be a real political will so that we can have a treaty in time for the expiration of Kyoto, a new treaty, in 2012. Sorry, bit of a long answer, but it's a good question and I tried to give it the best answer I could.
Thank you for your exposition, because it was extremely interesting. But I constantly heard you mentioning the emergent big countries like Russia, China and India. But I was missing to hear the word Brazil in the equation, because it's one of the emerging BRIC countries. And it's interesting that people are clearly addressing the issue from the point of view of the countries who create the damage. But into the equation, in my opinion, we should bring those countries who can be part of a solution. And Brazil clearly plays a very big role in here. First of all, it's a country that needs help in terms of preservation of their natural resources, because we all know of the race for precious woods and minerals into the Amazon. Moreover, the same sort of claims over territory from their neighbor countries. But it's interesting that in the old debate leading to the treaty in Copenhagen, somehow countries like Brazil, who could be a serious player into the solutions, since, as you mentioned, technology transfer, namely on nuclear power, could be a tricky security issue. We ain't hearing anything as such a strong statement. I would like to have your views on this.
No, thank you. Thank you. Indeed, it was a lapse on my part, not to mention Brazil, particularly as now we increasingly talk of the BRICS, of course, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, as the new emerging global powers, and certainly from an economic perspective and in terms of development, Brazil deserves that place. You also know that recently Brazil has discovered lots of very major oil gas reserves off its coast, which also means that it probably will be one of the world's largest producers of mineral oils resources in the next few years. But I suppose the main focus on Brazil is, of course, because of the Amazon. I can't remember the exact statistic, but I think to remember about 10% of carbon sinkage in the world today. And that was the storage of carbon in forests is explained by the Amazon alone, of course, which is the world's largest area. And not, obviously, you know better than I am, man, but if the current sort of contraction of the Amazon continues because of development, because of logging, because of agriculture, we are going to lose not only a great deal of biodiversity, but that resource. That's why I mentioned in reply to the previous question this idea of a cap and trade scheme. And I know that, for example, countries like Australia are already thinking along these lines of a cap-and-trade system which would balance the permits on CO2 emissions to investment for Brazil to replant the Amazon, or at least stop the current rate of attrition. That's going to be absolutely critical. So, yes, absolutely indeed. What President Lula says in Copenhagen, I think, is probably going to be as important as what President Jintao of China, Jintao, says as well.
I'm from the Philippines, and I'm very thankful to be given the opportunity to attend this lecture. In all your discussions this afternoon, you never spoke of educating people as a major, a significant way to reduce carbon emission and methane production. Can you say something about this?
Well, there are two schools of thought on this. Again, I don't pretend to be an expert, but if you look at the social debate, there are those who say that, you know, charity begins at home, and therefore the way to deal with the climate is to recycle, you remember, which we've all been doing for several years. I mean, here in Belgium, you know, we have special bags for plastics, special bags for paper, special bags for general rubbish. And if you mix up the bags, they don't take your rubbish away on a Thursday morning. So we've all become accustomed, you know, to taking our glass to special containers and being more conscious in our daily lives of, you know, buying smaller cars with smaller engines. We all buy lead-free petrol. This has been going for a long time. Now, there is a group of climate change scientists who believes that, yes, you know, Mao Zedong once said the longest march begins with the first step. Remember? So that, yes, you know, we have to make a start ourselves by setting an example, turning off the lights at home, taking one shower a day instead of two showers a day, losing less water, converting our homes to solar energy because it's also good for our gas bills or our electricity bills as well. But there is another group of scientists, at least I've read their interviews, who say, look, no, come on, at the end of the day, you know, you are misleading people if you give them the impression that, you know, all of these individual gestures are really going to have much of an impact. I mean, the pollution is still caused overwhelmingly by industrial production. Production of cars, production of cement, heavy industry, particularly of countries who are going through that heavy industrial model as part of their development, rather than going directly to services. And it's therefore a state-to-state affair. And it's all very well for people to go home at night feeling good about themselves, because, yes, today, you know, I walked to work, I didn't take my car. It's probably good for your health. As much as it's good for the environment, but not to see that as a substitute for the state state-to-state action, where 90% of the pollution lies, and where the real remedy has to come from. So I leave it to you to choose which line you want to take. But my conclusion would be that yes, you know, we should all act responsibly, but we should not kid ourselves, if I can use slang English, we should not delude ourselves that this in itself is a substitute for a Copenhagen agreement and a proper agreement on reductions between states. Also, you have to remember that it's only people who have the luxury and the good fortune to live in advanced industrial societies who also have the luxury of taking individual action to limit CO2 growth. 90% of the world's population do not live. You know, the people who live on $1 a day, over a billion in the world, they don't have the luxury. But they also, because they don't have the luxury, in terms of coal burning, in terms of agriculture, in terms of livestock, can be among the largest polluters in the future. So we need a global agreement, and that has to come first and foremost from governments. I thank you very much indeed for being, as always, such a great audience and for giving me a hearing. I hope that I haven't deterred you from coming to the next lecture in a few weeks' time. And again, thank you very much for today. Bye-bye.